Gav.
Hello, mother.
I guess we better get to it because
people annoying. Don't give a fuck about us.
People are think okay. We're annoying.
My disturbing fact, and this is going to be a series of disturbing facts because there's 50 states. So we're going to have a fact state here.
Nice.
Or more than one fact per state. And we were talking about this on our way home from New Mexico. And I was like, my mom's like, la, 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 plugging her ear. She's like, stop talking. Make this a disturbing fact thing. And so like, if there's stupid ones, we can combine them. Not stupid ones. They're all stupid.
They're all stupid.
It's stupid laws in each state is what it is. So we're going to start off strong with Alabama.
Okay.
Started off at the very top of the list.
Alrighty.
Super weird laws in Alabama is bear wrestling matches are prohibited.
Hmm.
I don't know. Maybe like don't get hurt. Yeah. I'm
trying to cut back on those anyway.
It is illegal for a driver to be blindfolded while operating a vehicle.
That's
like, I hope so.
Right. That seems like, obvious, but I guess not.
Right. I have some of the background of some of these laws. Our laws.
Because someone was stupid and did that.
Yes. But anyway, okay. This one's pretty fun. It's illegal to wear a fake mustache that causes laughter in church because it's distracting to sermons. And so, you're also not allowed to dress like a priest, I think. I read that one because it's disrespectful to priests if you dress like them.
Blasphemous.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I
can't believe that it's a law, though.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
It's considered an offense to open an umbrella on a street for fear it might spook horses.
Okay. What if there are no horses around?
Yeah, I don't know. Apparently, it's just not a thing you do there.
Okay.
And that's in Montgomery. You cannot chain your alligator to a fire hydrant.
Okay. I got nothing for that.
Okay, but I did find some things about this one. I was like, why is this a thing? Because it's a public safety hazard if you do that. The state has laws against keeping them in ways that are not contained and secure. While it's not illegal to chain alligators to fire hydrants, it is illegal to chain them to stationary objects. So I guess the law isn't specifically about fire hydrants. It's about stationary objects. And that's because it's obviously a public safety hazard. But it's also illegal to shoot or kill an unrestrained alligator. So I don't know. There's just a lot of crazy laws about alligators, I guess. And I don't really have actual like why this is a thing and how we discovered that like putting them on a fire hydrant was a bad idea.
Maybe because somebody did that and then there was a fire and then they couldn't open the fire hydrant because the alligator was there.
Yeah, I was thinking or alligators are smart and they're not fire hydrants aren't that tall. And so it could wiggle itself. Like if it's looped around the fire hydrant, like a leash, you know, yeah. It could get it off of there.
Yeah.
Easily.
It just seems rude to chain an alligator to anything, but okay.
Okay. My favorite law in Alabama to date is you may not have an ice cream cone in your back pocket at any time. Would you like to know the history of this one?
I would.
Because people used to put ice cream cones in their back pockets, like as an unsuspecting way to lure horses out and steal them.
Ew.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what I've got.
Okay. I was like thinking that you would sneak up behind somebody and put an ice cream cone in their back pocket.
And watch it melt and they'll be like, ha ha ha.
Watch them sit down instead of like a whoopee cushion.
Right. Nope, that ain't it.
All right. Well, thank you. Those are fucking random as shit. I don't know how disturbing they are, but. Random it's as shit.
Disturbing in a lot of ways that these are things that have happened that like driving blindfolded is illegal.
That's disturbing. I'll give you that.
I'm like, I want to know who tried that and why we thought this was a good idea. Like, I was going to say the reason why laws are laws is because someone did some dumb bullshit and then it became a law because of said dumb bullshit. But that's like some real next level, like
what bullshit.
The fuckery that turned into a law.
Yeah, that's fucking crazy. How did you get in this accident? Well, I was blindfolded.
I was blindfolded.
So I legitimately
did not. Why did that horse run away from you? I opened an umbrella on the street.
Crap on a cracker. Okay.
I wonder why my horse is loose. Oh, someone must have walked by with an ice cream cone in their pocket again.
And I'm still laughing about that guy that was wearing the fake mustache in church.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty silly. Okay.
Yeah, super silly.
What do you have for us today?
I have the dating game killer, which apparently is a very big case. And I like briefly had heard about it. But then when I asked you, I was like, hey, have you? Yeah, I know. I'm like, okay, fine. Well, whatever. I'm still doing it. So on yeah. that.
But there's also a recent movie that just came out.
Oh, well, I didn't know that either. But
with Anna Kendrick.
I don't really watch TV and I don't know who that is.
You know who Anna Kendrick is? The one from Pitch Perfect.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And she was also in A Simple Favor with Blake Lively.
Okay. Well, I didn't watch the movie and I didn't really know much about this case.
It
was good,
but it really only took place of the dating game. Okay. It didn't take place through the whole case of it.
Okay. Well, and yeah, this is just... Daphne and I talked about the fact that we need to make ourselves more visible by doing more high profile cases, which is not our original thing. Was like, oh, these have been done to death. We're going to do not so original ones. But then
you mean,
I mean, original ones, not original, not
not so high profile.
Yeah, not so high profile.
We're going to talk about lesser known things as opposed to more known things. Sorry. But here we are talking about known things. So it's fine.
Tired. As always,
we've talked about some known things.
We have. But. We said we were going to do more, so I like...
Off the top of my head, the Greenbrier ghost.
So I Googled most notorious murder cases or whatever, and this was number 10 on the list out of 10. I'm sure there's longer lists with more, but... And I was like, oh, I never really heard about this one before.
This is someone's opinion.
Yeah, exactly. I never really heard of this one before, so I was like, fuck it, I'm going to do it. Because, of course, all the other ones were like BTK, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, that kind of stuff. And I was like, I do not have that kind of
Richard
time in
Ramirez.
My life.
Richard Ramirez.
Yeah, Richard. Actually, he wasn't on that, I don't think, ooh, which is weird.
I have a weird fascination with him.
I know you do. It's creepy. Especially because he has really bad teeth.
And he's got horrible teeth.
And we like good
so
teeth.
So does that other one, though. That one I can't watch that case of on Netflix. I'll have to find the name of it. We've already talked about it on here before.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
But, like, his teeth are just so... Well, I have a thing for dental hygiene, for oral hygiene. And, like, if your teeth are gross, I just don't even want to know about it. Don't even with me. Okay, enough said.
Enough said. So, here we go. Rodrigo Hacas Alcala.
Alcala.
No.
Alcala.
It's A-L. It's Alcala.
Alcala?
Yeah. It's not Alcala. It's Alcala. But that's how it's spelled. So he was born August 23rd, 1943 in San Antonio, Texas. And he was the third of four children born to Raul Alcala Bacor and Ana Maria Gutierrez. And in 1951, Raul moved the family to Mexico and then he abandoned them 3 years later.
Ooh.
So then in 1954, like right after he abandoned them, moved the family back to a suburb of Los Angeles, so I'm assuming to be closer to her family would be my guess, but I'm not 100%
for sure. You said
they're
from San Antonio, then they moved to Mexico, and now they're in Los Angeles?
Mm-hmm. He was said to be academically gifted, popular, and he had all of his family's support. So he didn't have a bad childhood, you know? He attended various private schools, and in high school, he was on the yearbook committee, and he was on track and cross-country teams. So basically, just like a normal childhood.
He's a runner, he's a track star.
Yes. No reports of abuse or like a tumultuous family life other than the getting moved to Mexico, dad leaving and them getting moved back. But which sucks. But I don't think it makes a serial killer.
No, I guess. Do we know what he experienced in Mexico, though?
No, but there was like nothing.
Or what he experienced in San Antonio.
It said that his family was like very supportive. He had a really great family life.
OK,
so at some point. In time, he started going by Rodney or just Rod. So he started going by Rodney James Alcala. So he like lost the Rodrigo Hacas part, right?
More Americanized.
He Americanized himself, even though he was American to begin with. But
yeah, but if you have those Latin cultures, people sometimes drop that.
Sometimes. So in 1961, at the age of 17, he joined the army. And during his service, he was said to be manipulative, vindictive, and insubordinate. He was disciplined more than once for assaulting young women. And in 1964, he had what was described as a nervous breakdown, probably from like being...
In the army?
No, I think from being in trouble, from getting caught doing bad shit and getting in trouble and having like a spin out of like, it wasn't me. Yeah, temper tantrum, basically, okay, is what it sounded like. So they described it as a nervous breakdown. And then he went AWOL and he hitchhiked from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, which is where he was doing his military service, to his mother's house in California. And then like...
That's a cross-country trip.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's a long way. Wait, no, that's across the country. Yeah,
hitchhiking.
Yeah.
So thumb up. I don't know if like his mom called the military or what happened, but like he's AWOL and you're a property of the military when you're in the military. So he went back. I don't know the circumstances of him going back. So after being seen by a military psychiatrist, he was diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder and an above average IQ. They estimated his IQ was around 135. And the average, anything above 100 is considered to be smart.
Okay.
Above average. Because I think 85 to 100 is like normal or something.
Average.
Yeah, average. So after this event of him going AWOL and having his meltdown, that's a good word, meltdown.
Meltdown.
Yeah. He was medically
crash out, which is current, which is the current version of a meltdown.
He was medically discharged from the Army. And after his discharge, he went on to graduate from the UCLA School of Arts and Architecture. So he didn't get a dishonorable discharge. He gets to go home and he goes to school in California where he's been living with his mom and his sisters. On September 25th, 1968, Tali Shapiro, who's 8 years old, is walking to school in Los Angeles. Alcala pulled his car up next to her and he offered her a ride. And he was claiming to be a friend of her parents. And he's charming and good looking and has a great smile. Yep. And so, you know, trust this guy. It's so similar to Ted Bundy in a lot of ways. His, like, the way he operates.
The MO.
Mm-hmm. So he
gets you said art school. I think you left something important out that I know about this case. He was a photographer.
Yes, he was a photographer. But he went to the School of Arts and Architecture.
Yes, so, but for photography, I'm assuming.
And filmography.
Okay.
So because he claimed to have studied under Roman Polanski, but that was not true. Because he's a liar also.
Yeah.
I mean, weird.
Weird. What? He's a liar, too, on top of being a killer. He's a liar also.
He's a lot of bad things.
Anyway, yeah, you left. Sorry. I'm like, I know that that's an important part of the case.
It is. And we were going to get there, but that's okay.
Yeah, but you didn't say it.
I didn't say it. Yeah, but.
Okay. Yeah, but you didn't say it. And that's important.
Okay, so he was a photographer, but I don't know if he actually got his degree in photography or not. That's what he studied. So I don't know if he just got like a Bachelor of Arts or what he got. So he took little Tali back to his apartment and he hit her over the head with a metal bar and he raped her. And a passerby had witnessed Tali getting into Alcala's car and he had a weird feeling about it. And it's 1968, so you don't have a cell phone. And so he followed them back to Alcala's apartment and then he called the cops. And then the responding officers go and they knock on the door and Alcala answers the door, but he just like cracks it a little bit. And he's like, hey, I just got out of the shower. Let me get dressed. Give me a minute. And he shuts the door. And so the cops are like, okay, like, what the fuck? You know, he doesn't come back, obviously. And right, so
he runs away.
Then they knock again. He doesn't answer. They kick the door in. And as they're kicking the door in, Alcala goes out the back. But they don't know that he went out the back, right?
Oh, I was like expecting the feet through the window kind of thing.
No, he ran out the back door, but they didn't know that he went out the back door. Then the officer looks through and he sees Tali on the kitchen floor, unconscious and lying in a pool of her own blood with a metal bar across her neck that had been being used to strangle her.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And she's 8.
That's such a traumatic scene to walk into.
Yeah.
I mean, experiencing it also, but at least she's unconscious, hopefully, during the whole thing.
Hopefully. Well, they hit her over the head with the metal bar first.
Yeah. But so. Walking in on... Like, gosh, officers see some horrible things.
Yes, they do.
Sorry, continue.
That's okay.
The people officer, don't like when we talk.
People don't, but we need to talk a little. Otherwise, what's the point of both of us being here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of us could just tell the story, but that would be boring.
That would just, that's what we do. Any hoodles. So the officer observed Tali. So he like goes and checks her out, right? And she shows no sign of life. She's not breathing. And the officers kind of go through the apartment a little bit and they're looking for Alcala. Because as I said, he ran out the back door as they're kicking in the front door, but they didn't see him do that. They were like, well, where is this motherfucker? But he's not in the apartment.
Motherfucker Jones.
And so the police officer went back into the kitchen and by some miracle, Tali was gagging and she was trying to breathe. So the officer took life-saving measures. They called an ambulance and they got her to the hospital and she ended up being in a coma for 32 days. Aww. And spent months in the hospital. And luckily, she made a full physical recovery. But obviously, you're not going to make a mental recovery after that. Not fully. And during
take some time for that to heal.
During the investigation and the search of Alcala's apartment, police found photographic equipment and several photographs of young girls.
Creeper.
Yeah, in various states of, you know. So Alcala would be on the run until 1971. So this happened in 1968.
Oh, okay. So he stays gone for a long while.
While looking into Alcala's background during the manhunt, it was almost everyone's opinion that he was a great guy and he would never do anything like this because, oh my God, he's handsome and he's charming.
Right.
We just love him.
That's not Rodney. Rodney would never.
Yeah. He's too cute and we like him.
Yeah.
So while on the run, he assumed the alias John Berger, and he went to New York City, where he got into New York University's film school, where, again, he was considered popular and charming. And everybody likes him.
Okay, Ronald McDonald.
Oh, Berger. Okay. Yeah. So it took me a second. I'm like, what? Ronald McDonald's not very attractive.
No, he isn't. Clown-looking motherfucker.
Right. On June 12th, 1971... Alcala took his second victim, or he actually killed his first victim. So he, sorry, because he didn't kill Tolly.
You said there were pictures of other young women in compromising positions, though, so he didn't.
But they didn't know who they were. And there's no evidence, like, going back in this time period that he had done anything else. And there's no evidence to say that he did anything prior to that.
Okay, so we don't know if he killed them or not.
We don't, but I think he wasn't there yet.
Okay.
Let's say that. Like, he might have assaulted other people, but he wasn't there yet.
He wasn't a murderer yet.
Yeah. On June 12th, 1971, Alcala killed Cornelia Crilly, a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant. Sorry, I'm like, is it Crilly or Crilly? I think it's Crilly. I hate it when I don't say people's names right.
Especially victims,
it's really sad, you know?
Like, I get it.
Give them something.
The spotlight they deserve.
Exactly.
Because they're not known.
Exactly.
And instead, it's the Ted Bundys and the John Wayne Gacys and the Alcalas that are known.
Yep. The Richard Ramirez's. So Cornelia had been living with her boyfriend temporarily while she was getting her own apartment to share with another flight attendant just around the corner from his apartment. And on that day, Cornelia had spent the day moving into her new apartment. And when her boyfriend came home from work, he was surprised to find her door locked and then no one was answering the phone.
Aww.
And after she was unreachable for a while, which was highly unusual for her, her boyfriend called the police. And then when the police entered her apartment, they found Cornelia naked, bound and strangled with her own nylon stocking. And then she had something stuffed in her mouth, obviously, to keep her from screaming. So that really sucks.
Poor girl.
Poor girl.
That sucks so bad.
She had been brutally raped and had a bite mark on her breast at that time, with around 2,000 murders in New York City. So 1971.
Yeah.
So 1971 alone, there are about 2,000 murders and there's no leads. And then the lack of forensics as they exist today. It just sat cold for almost 40 years.
Wow. Almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years.
Okay.
Cornelia. Wow. Oh, wow. Sorry, I'm like, we're still... No, it's like, I don't know, when you think about what we have now and that they didn't have it then, and how did they even solve half the crimes they solved, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway...
Fingerprint experts.
Yes, exactly. So Cornelia was described as beautiful, ambitious. She exuded confidence and she carried herself extremely sophisticatedly.
Okay.
So she sounds cool.
Yeah.
She sounds independent, you know?
Yeah, I know. That's really sad. Just moved into her own new apartment and then... It's all taken from her.
The day of.
She's starting her new life. And it's like, just kidding.
Yeah. And they don't know, like,
fuck that.
Obviously how it happened. Because like I said, he was kind of a Ted Bundy-ish kind of guy. So maybe he was like, hey, let me help you move that furniture. Can I grab this for you? Because there was like no forced entry or anything.
Yeah.
So after Alcala's attack on Cornelia, he moved to New Hampshire. Because like, I got to scoot.
Yeah. Don't get caught here too long.
Yep, exactly. Because he's still on the run.
Because they knew who he was in California. Yeah.
Yeah. But don't forget, he's still on the run and he's living under an alias.
Yeah.
So he got a job
as Berger.
And he had two different burgers. He did BU and BE.
Okay.
And so it kind
just
of like.
Just depended on where he was. And
it kind of flip flopped
the audience
between which one was which. And so I'm not sure. So I'm not going to like be like, oh, this time he was an E and this time he was a U, because I saw it different ways in different places. So just know that he had two different John burgers, BER and BUR. Okay.
Okay.
So he moved to New Hampshire and he got a job at an arts summer camp as a counselor for children attending the camp. And this is where he uses for the first time the slightly different alias. Okay, so different
flip flops from either an E to a U or a U to an E.
Exactly. In early 1971, he was added to the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitive list. And in August of 1971, he was recognized by two campers who were attending the camp, and they noticed his photo in the post office on the FBI poster. And so they like went back to the camp and told the director, they're like, hey, Mr. Berger is actually this dude who's on the 10 most wanted list. Yeah. So the director of the camp called the police and then he was arrested. Right,
they didn't alert him to know that they knew who he was. They played it coy and played it cool like they should.
Exactly. So they called the police and he was arrested and then he was extradited back to California. And so think about this. This was in August, right? He killed Cornelia in June.
Okay.
So if he would have just been caught 2 fucking months earlier, Cornelia would still be with us.
Yeah.
So fucking sad. When it came time for the trial, Tali's family had moved to Mexico and they would not let Tali return to testify against Alcala. So without primary witnesses, prosecutors were unwilling to charge Alcala with rape and attempted murder. And he was just charged and convicted of child molestation and was registered as a sex offender. Well, just. But still, he fucking brutally attacked and raped this girl and kidnapped her. And
no, it's what I'm saying. Just. That's all he's getting for all of his brutality.
Yeah, exactly. Just a fucking child molester and had to register as a sex offender.
That's it.
And it pisses me off because why couldn't the responding officers be witnesses to testify against him? I guess because they didn't physically witness him doing it.
Yeah, but what about the guy who followed him, too?
Well,
they not have that guy's record?
Yeah. There's so many reasons why they should have been able to fucking do something besides be like, oh, you're just a child molester. Not just.
No, but that's all they did. They said you're just that. You're not more than that.
You're not a kidnapper. You're not an attempted murderer. You're not a rapist. Yeah. You're just, you know.
You're just
a piece of shit. You're a mild piece of shit than the bigger piece of shit that you actually are.
Right. They're only charging him with lesser than his crime.
Exactly. So unfortunately, the judge sentenced him only to 1 year to life. So basically an indeterminate amount of time that his actual time served would be up to the parole board, who released him after serving just under 3 years. So he served 34 months.
Jeez.
Yep.
So he got off pretty easy for all of his brutality.
Yeah. And that's because they thought that he showed signs of rehabilitation because he's charming and he's handsome and he's manipulative.
He couldn't have done something like that.
No.
Not Rodney.
They were really fucking wrong.
Yeah.
He was not rehabilitated and should not have fucking let this shithead out. So the details of the attack should have been enough to put him away for life.
Yeah.
Even if Tali didn't testify, it was his apartment. The police were there. The police saw him answer the door. Like, there's just so many fucking things that it's like shouldn't be considered circumstantial evidence that the prosecutor wouldn't want to pursue more. It was the prosecutor's decision to be like, you know what? It seems like it'll probably be hard to seal the deal if we do a more complicated. So let's just do this. And Rodney Alcala's like, OK, cool. Works for me.
Yeah.
So because he accepted that, right? So he accepted that plea deal.
Of course he's going to accept a lesser charge than what he really deserves.
Exactly. So,
shit.
Yeah. It's just mind boggling, to be honest.
Yeah.
So after his release, he was hired by the Los Angeles Times to work as a typesetter, and he advertised himself as a photographer, and he took random photography jobs like weddings and senior pictures and stuff like that.
Great. Let him be around the public.
Of the public, exactly. Any public. He was a registered sex offender at this time, and no one checked or like looked into his background or anything.
Nice.
Yep. So in 1977, Alcala moved back to New York City with the permission of his parole officer, which is weird because when you get paroled, like, don't you have to stay where you got paroled?
Yeah, you would think.
I think so. I mean, I don't know. I've never been on parole.
Yeah, me neither. But I'm pretty sure that's the way it works.
I think it does as well. But anyway, his parole officer is like, yeah, sure, it's cool. Go across the country. It's whatever.
Yeah, sure. It's cool. Whatever. Right? Yep, I don't need to monitor you.
Yeah.
You're good. You're reformed.
I'll take your word for it.
You would never do anything ever again, would you?
No, you're popular and attractive and you have a great smile and you're charming.
Yeah, she was probably a woman.
She wasn't. But anyway, so.
Yeah, he wasn't.
After only 1 week back in New York City on July 15th, 1977, he claimed the life of his next victim.
I was going to say he killed someone else.
So just one fucking week.
Yay, let's let him out. Let's do things with this guy. Let's let him prove that he's still a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. God, it's like Samuel Little.
Yeah. And was there anything in the interim? I don't know. So there's obviously...
We don't know what happened in the interim of the 1 week. We just know 1 week later
Like between the time that he was released, because he got caught in 1971, went to trial probably presumably, what, 1972?
He was out, 1975?
1975-ish. And then he has 2 years of doing who knows what.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. So I'm assuming he probably didn't lay low.
Probably not. I don't know.
It's like Samuel Little.
It's just,
do you remember that he literally murdered that woman and was in the car with her?
Mm-hmm. And the police were like, meh, it's probably fine.
Probably nothing happened.
Probably.
She was probably already dead.
Probably, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The fuck?
Uh-huh. So Ellen Hoover.
We shouldn't be such cop haters because half of them are good, half of them are bad.
Yeah, I'm like not a cop hater. In this case, I'm a prosecutor hater and
sometimes
I'm a parole officer hater. And
I'm a lazy cop hater. I'm a bad cop hater. Great cops. I'm a great cop lover.
Yeah, I'm a great cop lover as well. So Ellen Hoover was a 23-year-old musician and artist. And Ellen came from a prominent showbiz family. Her father owned a famous nightclub in Hollywood called Ciro's. And Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin were her godfathers. So that tells you anything.
Yeah, so she was... Connected, well-known.
Connected. On July 15th, she missed a dinner and theater date, and then no one could get a hold of her. Ellen just vanished. No one had seen or heard from her for days, and when her mother reported her missing to the police, they go to her apartment, they find her apartment empty, like no forced entry or anything, but her checkbook is there. There were things that her passport, like if you're leaving, you take.
Yeah. Or if it's a break and gone wrong.
Right.
Been gone.
So a neighbor told police that on July 15th, a tall, shabbily dressed man with a long ponytail knocked on her door. A friend also told police that they saw her talking with a man who fit the neighbor's description and that Ellen had explained that he was a photographer that she had met at an unemployment office. And I don't know the circumstances surrounding that, but her friend told the police.
Okay.
So this guy who she missed the date with also told police that she told him the morning of July 15th that she had a lunch date with a photographer. Because remember, she's a musician and an artist, right?
Yeah.
So she's connected. She's trying to continue to be connected in probably that world.
Right.
And perhaps maybe
she's looking for someone to shoot her next album cover.
Yeah. Or maybe this guy knows who she is. And so he's trying to connect with her. I don't know. So she's having lunch with this guy, this photographer. And then after that, she's going to
obviously it's Rodney.
Yes. And then she's going to Bloomingdale's after that. And then she'd be home by 4 so she could get ready for their dinner date and going to the theater.
Yeah.
On Ellen's calendar, on the 15th, she had written that she was meeting John Berger. Ellen's body wouldn't be found for almost a year until June 14th, 1978.
Okay.
Her badly decomposing body was found buried under heavy rocks on a hillside overlooking the Hudson River, about a half a mile west of Phelps Memorial Hospital in North Tarrytown near the Rockefeller Estate.
Fuck.
She was identified through dental records. And 2 rings and an ankle bracelet and a barrette that was found with her body. Her cause of death was unknown, obviously. A homicide, obviously. Yeah. But they didn't know specifically what happened. Police were looking for a photographer with a history of sex crimes, and they have the name John Berger. So in interviews with more than 200 people, police detective learned the man's true identity, which they refused to disclose to the press. And, you know,
cool.
Yeah. So this man was known to go to the bank of the Hudson north of the city to watch sunsets. And that's what led the police to search that area.
Okay.
Because they're still, because she's from this prominent family and they're like advertising in the newspaper. They're like putting up reward money and all this stuff. So the cops are like still staying on top of it instead of just being like, well, it's one of 2,500 murders.
There's a reward. So there's probably tips coming in, whether they're legitimate or not.
Exactly.
Need to continue to be investigated. And
yeah.
All these things are keeping it alive as opposed to it going cold.
Right.
not just the police doing their jobs.
Right.
Other outside circumstances.
Yes, correct. Yeah, it was highly or not publicized. Outside
circumstances, but you know.
It was highly publicized.
Circumcised that are keeping it alive.
Circumcised?
Circumstances that are keeping it alive.
Okay.
Circumlife.
Circumlife.
That's what I meant to say. Circumstances keeping it alive.
Okay.
My brain just combined all the things
all
together.
All the words together. And by this time, Alcala had already left New York City on a road trip, making his way slowly back to California.
Of course.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a year later. So in the spring of 1977, Christine Thornton was heading to Montana with her boyfriend to pan for gold. She had recently revealed to her mother that she was going to have a baby. And then the family, like, never heard from her again.
Oh, my gosh.
Her sister, Kathy, immediately feared the worst. Christine and her boyfriend had a rocky relationship, and he had physically abused her, and she thought that he had done something to Christine. Christine's remains were found on April 26th, 1982.
Okay, so 5 years later?
Yeah, from 77 to 82.
So she's well decomposed.
Mm-hmm. Near Granger, Wyoming. And because she was unidentified, they referred to her as Granger Greta. Sorry, I'm also struggling. It wouldn't be until July of 2015 that she would be identified.
Oh my gosh.
So long, long time later.
Yeah. Who knows if her whole family is even still around.
Yeah.
And was he her boyfriend?
No.
Okay.
No. Not the boyfriend. Spoiler alert. Not the boyfriend.
Well, I didn't know if he was the boyfriend or not.
But 1977, it's not like if somebody disappears that you can find. You know what I mean? Like, not so easy.
Yeah,
I guess.
Because a lot of times they think they're runaways and they're not willing to look
into it. Well, no, not even that. But like, you have no way of like, this is her boyfriend's name. Do you know where he is? Like, because her sister was like continually looking for her. So she would contact like the Social Security Administration to see if she had like worked somewhere so that they could track her down that way. Like, her sister did all this investigative work trying to find her sister.
Yeah.
But she couldn't really do that with the boyfriend because she didn't have his like Social Security number.
She didn't have
number.
His info like that.
Yeah, she didn't have that much information other than obviously he was a douchebag also. Well,
clearly it wasn't him.
But yeah, not him. So Rodney Alcala appeared on The Dating Game in 1978. And by this point, he had already killed at least five women. And I say at least because, like I said, there's this time that we don't know what he was doing.
Wait, we only know of the three, though.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Because I'm going chronologically of how the case unfolds, but then it goes back.
Okay.
Okay. So just follow along.
Okay, I'm just following. I'm just listening. Along. I'm just here for the ride.
Yeah. So in 1978, because we went to 1977, but so by this point, he had already killed at least five women and had been charged with the attempted murder of an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
But he didn't really, he'd been charged with that. But remember, he didn't end up.
He killed Ellen, Cornelia, and then Greta.
But also Christine. So wait, that's only three.
Greta, that's the...
Granger Greta is Christine.
Yes, Jane Doe.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry. So,
that's okay.
Christine is her real name.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
So three that are chronologically for sure tied to him until later on.
Okay.
So that's why I'm doing this.
Okay.
This is
so
how
we
this is
know
how I'm doing
five
it.
Happening. Sorry, right. Sorry. I'm just clarifying this for myself and probably for people listening because you didn't mention five names.
I did not.
You only mentioned three.
But we'll get there.
Okay.
I feel like I always pretty much wrap it up pretty concisely.
Yeah, but
the road getting there
while
is
you're
confusing.
Telling the story, sometimes it doesn't always make sense.
But I can't tell you the back half, the latter.
We know
half
later
of the story.
That more come out, but on the timeline chronologically. He's on The Dating Game now.
Yes.
Which is how he got his famous name.
That's how he got his famous name. So at this point, he'd already killed at least five women and had been charged with the attempted murder of an 8-year-old girl, which he'd actually end up getting charged with. That's what he was initially charged with. But then they ended up playing it down to child molestation. Let him go because he's cool. He's fine. He's got a great smile. He's rehabilitated. See you. Good luck. Not only can you go from being paroled, but we're going to let you move to New York.
Right, where you're going to kill someone else. And then on the way back, you're going to kill someone else.
Yes.
That we know of, that we've already talked about right now.
So at the time of casting, the producer and the contestant coordinator disagreed on whether or not he should be a contestant. The contestant coordinator thought that because he was attractive and he was a successful photographer, that he would be great for the show. And how successful of a photographer he is just based on his own words.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any like...
references. It's
yeah,
just
no Pulitzer
portfolio.
Prizes or anything.
She's like, yeah, I took these pictures.
Yeah, I'm so famous or I'm very successful. Here's my portfolio. The contestant coordinator had like a great feeling about him and thought, ooh, yeah, let's do this. And so the contestant.
Right, he's a charmer.
The contestant coordinator. So do you understand that? There's three contestants.
Yes,
so
she's like the casting director.
Yeah. So there's the three guys that are going to be trying to win the date with the Bachelorette.
Right.
So he's one of those.
Right. And the way it's the way it's done on this one, I think, right, is like they're in their own like little cubicle kind of situation happening and she can't see them and they're just answering questions. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah,
exactly.
But the audience can see them. She just can't see them.
Correct. Correct. The casting producer, on the other hand, thought that he had a strange personality.
Okay. So one of the casting people is absolutely just taken with him. The other one's like, I don't know about this guy.
Not so sure. In 1978, there wasn't the technology that allowed for a background check or like the national databases or anything.
Of course there wasn't. So
ultimately, he was cast as Bachelor number one. And by the end of the show, he was chosen by the Bachelorette. After the show, they were introduced and the Bachelorette had an uneasy feeling. And she called the show's producer the next day and said that she couldn't go out with Alcala because he had, quote, weird vibes coming off of him. So she's smart. Good.
She knew better.
And that he was very strange and that she wasn't comfortable around him.
Good.
And so her intuition may have saved her life.
Good.
Because, you know, obviously he didn't kill everyone he came in contact with. But
that would be a lot of dead people.
Just wait, man.
Oh, I know there's a lot of dead people, but that would be a lot more.
But still, wait. Okay. So later in interviews, Bachelor number two said that Alcala was creepy. And when they were in the green room before taping the show, Alcala told him, quote, I always get my girl. And he said that like it was weird and edgy and like not like a hey, man. It was more like a no, 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 no. Like,
yeah,
exactly.
As a knife is stabbing. Yeah, so he's not cool and calm and he's cocky and not humble about it at all.
No.
Douchey about it.
Douchey and weird. Not always so charming.
He's like power tripping about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Aggressive.
He's good looking.
Aggressive, assertive.
Yes, that's
all of those
great
things.
Those are great descriptions.
On June 20th, 1979, 12-year-old Robin Samso was going to start her first day of work answering phones at a ballet studio in exchange for lessons. But first, she planned to play at the beach for a few hours with her best friend, Bridget. Later, Bridget would say, I could definitely see a gentleman with dark hair. I mean, he honed in on us like really like a shark in the water honing in on a seal.
Ew.
And he goes, can I take your girl's pictures? And Robin goes, sure. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, pops up Jackie, my neighbor, who's an adult. And she goes, Bridget, is everything okay? Are you girls all right? And the man, he took that camera and he turned his head down and you could almost see like smoke coming off of his dress shoes. He was just gone. Robin and Bridget turned to go back home and Robin had thrown her beach towel and everything into a bag. And she was like, well, I'm going to get going. And I go, well, take my bike and don't stop. Okay.
Okay. So sorry, I'm making a face. You couldn't hear me.
That's okay. I guess so. Robin's actually headed to the ballet studio and Bridget's headed home, or they're both headed home in different directions or whatever.
Yeah.
But it seems like, I guess the guy was more focused on Robin. And so that's why Bridget's like, get on my bike and skadoot.
Yeah. She's being more observant. Get on my bike. Go straight to where you need to go. Do not stop for anyone.
Just go. Just
do
go
not
home.
Stop. Go.
Just don't stop. Go. That was the last time that anyone saw Robin alive.
Aww.
Robin's ballet teacher called when she did not arrive for her lesson that day. And the backstory of her being 12 and going to work at the ballet studio was that she had trained at this ballet studio, if you will, like this dance studio, since she was 4 years old. And she's 12 and her mom got into an accident. So they couldn't really afford to keep paying for her lessons. So the woman who owned the studio, she's like,
I'll trade you lessons.
Exactly. If you work for me, then I'll trade lessons for you. Because it's like, well, you're not a 12-year-old working. But that makes sense in that
it's not like a child labor issue. It's like she's going to do a little sum for me and I'll give her lessons for free.
Right. Because they can't afford to pay for it right now.
Yeah.
Her family immediately called 911 after the woman teacher called them and said she did never show up.
Right. And then Bridget's account's like, ugh, yep. Creepy motherfucker.
Bridget told police that she knew it was the man who took their picture. She was like, for sure, 100% that he was the one that did it. On July 12th, 12 days after Robin went missing, a fire crew found her body in a remote location about 40 miles from where she was last seen. And by the time Robin was found, she was just bones because of animal activity.
40 miles away? How did they know to look out there?
They didn't. It was a fire crew. Like fire mitigation.
Oh, so they just randomly stumbled upon her.
They just randomly stumbled upon her. And like 12 days and she's like totally just bones.
That's so sad.
So sad. And so like her mom was like,
all the when she was elements.
It was more animal activity than anything. I'm not going to go into all the gory details, but her mom, like the police contacted her and they were like, we think we found her. And she's like, well, let us come down and identify her. And they're like, well, there's really not much to identify. They're like, well, we could identify her by like her blonde hair or her. And they're like, there's no hair. Like her all the way down to the bone, her bones had like teeth marks in them and stuff.
Oh, gosh.
And then, but like not too far from her body was, you know, scattered in the area was like a shoe that had her name in it and all of this kind of stuff, right?
Dental records maybe too.
Yeah. So Bridget was able to give a great description of the man, which resulted in a composite sketch that would lead to his arrest. Matt Murphy, who had been Alcala's parole officer, called detectives and said that the sketch is of Rodney Alcala. He used to be on my caseload. You need to take a look at him because he was like, oh, that's him, like for sure.
Yeah, well,
but that I was just the parole officer that let him move to New York.
Oh, gosh. Well, I just want to say that good for Bridget for being observant and checking her surroundings and paying attention and, you know, just being observant, looking out for her friend, although it didn't work out very well. I'm sure she feels a lot of guilt around the situation. Good for her for paying attention.
Yeah. And being able
that's a life skill that everyone should have is being observant, knowing, paying attention to your surroundings, paying attention to people who are being creepy and staring for maybe too long. Make them uncomfortable. Stare right the fuck back.
Exactly. Good answer. Good job. And the sketch like totally looks like him. So she did a really good job on
that. That's what I'm saying. Good on her for being observant.
Yeah. Cause like I said, the parole officer was like, that's him. Like, no doubt about it. Like, it doesn't just look like him. It's him.
Yeah, that is him.
Alcala was living with his mother in Monterey Park, very close to where Robin's remains had been found. Alcala had no alibi and no one could account for his whereabouts around the time Robin went missing. He was arrested and charged with the kidnapping and murder of Robin Samso.
Okay.
When Alcala's sister came to visit him in jail, the conversation was being recorded, which is standard. You know, those jail phones, like the classes between you and like you're on the phone and they're on the phone and those are recorded. Those calls are recorded.
Yeah.
Not really calls, but, you know, the conversations. So Alcala mentioned a storage unit in Seattle. He told her to do him a favor and go clear it out, get everything out of there, like get rid of everything. Get rid of everything. So police had found a receipt during the search of his home at the time of his arrest for the storage unit. And police beat Alcala's sister to the storage unit and they hit the literal mother load.
Good.
There were hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures of dozens and dozens of young women, some very, very young, and young boys in various states of dress and undress and in real compromising positions. And police learned that Alcala had rented the unit and moved his stuff there 9 days after Robin's remains were found.
So he's a total child predator.
Yeah.
A predator just in general.
Because, yeah, not all of his victims are young.
Children.
Yeah, not all of his victims are young, but he's just a predator. He has no boys, girls, women, children.
He has no victim type.
Yeah, he's an equal opportunity piece of shit. Yes, exactly. So 9 days after her remains.
EOPOS. Equal opportunity piece of shit.
There you go.
Sorry, my brain had to do that.
That's okay. I understand how brains have to do stuff like that. So 9 days after Robin's remains were found, he was like, I'm going to Seattle. I'm putting my shit up there.
Yeah.
Two states away because he's in Northern California, Oregon, Seattle.
Okay.
So he went far to try to hide the shit because he's cocky and he's already gotten out of shit. And so he's like,
I know I'm somewhat on the radar, but I need to be off of it.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was pretty cocky in the fact that he wasn't going to get caught. A tiny silk bag filled with earrings and other jewelry was found among his things, which Alcala claimed were his. He's like, no, that's all my stuff. Those are my earrings. When police showed the jewelry to Robin's mother, she recognized a pair of gold ball studs that Robin often borrowed from her.
Aww.
So, yes, really sad.
That's really sad.
In February of 1980, Alcala went on trial. Almost 50 witnesses testified, and the trial lasted 2.5 months. The jury convicted Alcala and sentenced him to death for the kidnapping and murder of Robin Samso. But because her body had been so ravaged by animals, the molestation charge had been dismissed, which is fine. Get him for fucking murder.
Get him for something that's bigger than
molestation,
sexual assault, because we know how that went last time.
Exactly. Later, his conviction was overturned.
Don't let history repeat itself, especially with this motherfucker.
Exactly. So later, his conviction was overturned. The state of California Supreme Court ruled that he did not receive a fair trial because the jury had been told about Alcala's prior sex crimes, including the attack on Tali, which is like, don't you think people should know that? But I guess, you know, it's whatever. I don't like, I guess it's not relevant to that actual trial, but it is. It's relevant to their character, but whatever. You know how they're always like, well, that's not admissible in court. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So there you go. After a second trial, Alcala was again convicted and sentenced to death in 2001.
Yeah, they're like, regardless of whether we know about his previous convictions or not, he's still a piece of shit and should be sentenced to death.
Exactly. But he like keeps appealing and appealing and appealing because he's never going to take accountability.
Of course not.
So it goes all the way up to the Federal Appeals Court. And in 2001, the Federal Appeals Court overturned his conviction again based on evidence that Alcala didn't present. He was like, hey, I had all this stuff I was going to present and I didn't do it, or my attorney didn't do it. Basically blamed it on the attorney. So in 2010...
Right, that his defense wasn't really on their money.
Yeah. In 2010... In New York City, 39 years after Cornelia Crilly and 33 years after Ellen Hoover were killed, cold case detectives were finally able to link Alcala to the crimes and identified him as the killer of both women. In Cornelia's case, there was a letter under her body and it had a fingerprint that was lifted from the envelope, and it was finally matched to Alcala through the FBI's database.
Right. When it finally got rang into the police system, it was like, oh, we have a match.
Yep. Well, I don't know if it finally did, but I mean, it's cold case, right? So it's 39 years later, and maybe they're like, hey, this guy's... But it's 2010, so it's quite a while
after. I think they reopened them, though, and they're like, with technology coming through and stuff, I think
if they have the resources.
Yeah.
So the bite mark on her breast was also matched to Alcala's dental impression. In Ellen's case, investigators knew that John Berger was Alcala, because remember I said that they knew his true identity?
Yeah.
But they knew it at that time, so I don't know why they didn't pursue it at that time, you know?
Lack of resources?
Yeah, I don't know. But you think if somebody killed somebody and you got a famous family and you are like, yeah, we know his identity. Like, why 33 years before you go after the motherfucker?
What do you mean they knew his identity?
Because the police, that's how they found her body, was because that guy frequented that area and they knew his true identity.
Unless it was the alias of the John Berger.
They said they knew John. It said that they knew who John Berger's true identity was.
Oh, well, then I don't know.
I don't either. And I could not figure it out. I could not find it. In Ellen's case, investigators knew that John Berger was Alcala, as I said, and he had been seen near the Rockefeller estate where her body was found. They also had witnesses who saw Alcala with a woman who looked like Ellen, and the man was carrying a camera case. New York would have to wait, though, to bring Alcala to trial until his trial in California was over, because he's getting a third fucking trial in California.
Right, for Robin, for the appeals.
Mm-hmm. So DNA also linked Alcala to four other murders. Jill Barcombe was killed on November 9th, 1977. So this is where the at least five come in. But it wasn't until 2010.
Okay, so we know two more in this time frame.
At least. So we're getting there. But this, because it's not till 2010 that we get this information. So that's why I'm telling
you. They're connected.
They know in 1978 that he was on the dating game. And in 1979, he killed Robin. And
right. They knew he killed these women in the time of the or before the dating game. They knew that they had those connected to him through whatever reason. And then they found out through DNA or whatever later down the line that more happened in that time frame.
Well, but when he went on the dating game, they only knew about, for sure, the attack on Tali.
Well, yeah, because they hadn't gotten him on the other ones.
The other ones were unsolved. So DNA, as I said, linked Alcala to four other murders. Jill Barcombe was killed on November 9th, 1977. She was an 18-year-old girl from Oneida, New York, and he had disposed of her body on a dirt path near Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles. She was found in a knee-to-chest position and strangled with a pair of blue rope ties and beaten, and she had 3 bite marks on her right breast. Initially, it was thought that she was a victim of the Hillside Stranglers, because this is also going on at this time, but it was later determined that her murder was unrelated to their murder spree. Also, before he killed Robin in the arrest, or like sometime maybe after he got arrested, they questioned him for being the Hillside Strangler, or one of them, because they knew it was a team, right?
Okay.
But anyway, so they were are you the
unless
guy?
Unless I heard more details about them, I don't really know them.
Okay.
Anyway. Okay, so he did that in the time frame of his parole officer being like, yeah, dude, it's cool. Head on back to New York.
No, this is in California.
Hers is in California, mm-hmm. This girl?
She was from Oneida, New York.
Oh, but it was in California. Yeah. Okay, got it.
So he's back in, because remember, he went to New York after he got out on parole. He killed Ellen, and then he went back to California. And then on his way back to California, he killed Christine, if not who knows how many others.
Okay.
And then now he's back in California. He killed Jill.
Okay.
And like I said, they thought Hillside Strangler. So they weren't really looking in another direction at that time.
Okay.
They were only looking at them.
Are those the two guys that had the van that traveled around with the hitchhikers? And
they're cousins. There's a couple of the van hitchhiker guys.
Okay.
So, but
I wonder if it's the people
Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono were their names.
The Hillside Stranglers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think cousins. If I recognize them, the names or not. Okay, sorry.
Anyway, it
doesn't matter.
This is all
here or there because he's not them and they didn't
also,
kill her. This is his victim.
Yeah. And also, I didn't mention it, but when Ellen was killed, New York City is also at that time dealing with the Son of Sam. So they have him as
a nasty motherfucker.
A serial killer also. So it's like, and then you have this other guy that's a serial killer that's interweaving himself into across
that
the fucking
so
country
fucking
from back
looking,
to here, there, and everywhere.
The Son of Sam.
David Berkowitz.
Yeah. He's one of those ones that for me, it's like, I don't know, Richard Ramirez probably should be the one who's causing my nightmares because he's creepy and ugly looking, but instead I'm fascinated by him. David Berkowitz, it's like, oh my God, I just can vision his fro and like the hair he leaves behind and like, ugh.
Ugh. Okay. All right. Thank you for that.
Sorry.
But that goes back to like one of the disturbing facts that I did, where there's however many serial killers operating at one time in the United States.
Yeah.
Or like how many serial killers
you'll
actually pass by in your life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're focused on the Hillside Stranglers and they're focused on Son of Sam. But in the meantime, there's also Rodney Alcala and Ted Bundy and, you know, on and on and on.
Richard Ramirez. Operating in the same area.
Exactly.
Who also doesn't have a victim type and is just
random.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking what's his nuts operates by 12 different names that just got caught not that long ago.
Oh.
D'Angelo.
Yeah. James D'Angelo.
Not James. Is it James?
No, Joseph.
Joseph.
Joseph D'Angelo.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
Sorry.
That's okay. No, but it's a point, right?
Yeah, that there's however many serial killers and they're trying to focus in on, oh, that was the Son of Sam. Those were the Hillside Stranglers.
Mm-hmm. And yes. This is the same MO. So anyway, Georgia Wickstead was killed on December 16th, 1977. She was a 27-year-old nurse and she was last seen when she drove another nurse home from a bar. They like had some drinks after work. And when Georgia missed work the following day, her coworkers reported her missing. When police arrived at her apartment, there were signs of forced entry and they found her lying dead, posed naked on her bedroom floor, strangled with her own nylons.
Aww.
And she had been sexually assaulted and her skull had been bashed in and her genitals had also been mutilated.
Aww.
So it's different. Like he hasn't done this all the time.
Where he's mutilating. Changing it up every time
he
does something.
Yeah.
So something changes every time he kills someone. And that's probably because he's so smart. He's trying to throw them off his path.
And because he's fucking crazy.
Well, he's sadistic, obviously, but I'm talking about how he's cocky and thinks he's never going to get caught.
Yeah.
That he's like, well, if I do this, then it'll look like the Hillside Stranglers that they're trying to catch. If I do this, it'll look like someone else. If I do this, it'll match this person's victimology.
And if I change it up all the time, they're not going to think it's one single person.
Yeah, they're going to connect it to everyone else but me.
Charlotte Lamb was killed on
June. Think I only like little girls. Let me prove something else to some to them.
Fucker.
I know.
Charlotte Lamb was killed.
Such a piece of shit.
Charlotte Lamb was killed on June 24th, 1978. She was a 32-year-old legal secretary from Santa Monica. She was found dead in the laundry room of her apartment complex where she lived in El Segundo, California. She had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled with a shoelace. She was posed with her hands behind her back, and her earrings were later identified as some of the jewelry that was found in Alcala's storage unit.
Ugh.
So these four victims that I'm saying, remember, they were tied by DNA.
Yes.
So Jill Parenteau.
Yeah, how you said there's probably more. These are our definites.
Mm-hmm. Jill Parenteau was killed on June 13th, 1979. She was a 21-year-old girl. So like 2 weeks before Robin.
I was like, wait a sec. We're getting like real inch into where he's arrested, though.
Mm-hmm. That's the other thing.
Okay.
It's like, damn it. Like, just got him a little bit sooner, right?
Yeah.
She was a 21-year-old.
Well, if they would have just kept him on tally.
Yeah, no shit. No fucking shit.
Well, if they would have kept him on tally, then Cornelia would still have been murdered. Perhaps he, I guess, maybe killed in the interim there, too.
Yeah.
But they know for a fact Cornelia, so that would have, that unfortunately would have.
Still have happened.
Yeah, but that would have been it.
That would have been it.
If they would have convicted him on tally for more.
Yes.
Than they did.
Jill Parenteau was killed on June 13th, 1979. She was a 21-year-old key punch operator. She left work early that day to go to a baseball game. When she didn't come home or didn't come to work the next day.
She was a what operator?
A computer key punch operator. I don't know. It's 1979.
That's so interesting. Well, remember that time we talked about the switchboard operator?
Yeah.
And you were like, oh, that would have been such a cool job. And I'm like, that's my brain was just doing that. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I was like, what an interesting job. That's probably automated now.
Yeah. It's probably like data entry.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Computer okay. key punch operator. Cause you know, computer technology, 1979. Oh. When she didn't come to work the next day, she was reported missing. And when police went to her apartment in Burbank, they found signs of forced entry. She was found dead on her bathroom floor. She was naked and posed with pillows under her shoulders. She had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and strangled. Her killer cut himself on the way out, crawling through a window, which is what later conclusively identified Alcala as her killer, because they had saved it. So yes. Thank goodness, because all the cases where you're like, oh, it went missing. I don't know where the evidence is. My bad, huh?
Right.
Sorry.
It burned in fire.
Yeah.
It burned in the great fire of whatever town we're talking about, because there's always a great fire in whatever town we're talking about.
Yes. In trial, a friend of Jill's testified that they had met Alcala at a club several times before, and not like that they had went to meet him, but like he hung out where they hung out kind right. of thing.
So. Yes. No, that makes sense.
Okay. California prosecutors took the opportunity of this third trial that Alcala had insisted on. Remember, he made his own fate in this one uh-huh. to try all five of the cases together.
Huh. Good.
Yep.
About damn time.
Yeah. And it's pretty not normal that they do that. But they're like, yeah. Hey, well, since we're going to start over from scratch and we know that all of these are actually tied to you and you have never been accused of them or tried of them, but now we know it's you, we're just going to go ahead and add those to this.
Yeah, we're just going to add them to the list.
Yeah. So piece of shit.
Yeah. Well, good. I'm glad they did that, though.
Alcala served as his own attorney, of course, because Cocky. I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
Alcala was found guilty of all five murders.
Good.
In the penalty phase, the prosecution had a surprise witness. They called Tali Shapiro. She told the jury.
I had heard about that they called her later in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So 2010.
Yeah, way fucking later in life. Yep. She was 8 when it happened.
Yep. Little in 1968.
Girl. Yeah, poor little girl.
Tali Shapiro told the jury, I'm one of Rodney Alcala's first and one of his only living victims. It should have stopped with me. Why in the world were there so many other victims when it was a known fact what he did to me?
True.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. It's like, just because she didn't testify, how many other people could have been like, for sure, this guy did this.
Right. It was definitely this guy. Mm-hmm. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
But, you know, again, it was him. The prosecutor is like, I don't think we'll get a conviction on that. So we're just going to do this. And he was like, okay, cool. It's whatever. I'll take that. The jury imposed the death penalty again on Alcala.
Okay.
In June of 2012, he went back to New York City to stand trial for the murders of Cornelia and Ellen.
Okay.
The trial was over in December, and surprisingly, he pled guilty because he denied every fucking crime he was ever accused of or tried for.
Of course he did.
He just was like, nope, wasn't me, wasn't me. And then these ones, he's like, fine, whatever. It was me. I did it. He was sentenced to 25 years to life. So if he were to ever be released by the state of California, he would have to go to New York to serve that sentence.
Okay.
In 2013, Kathy Thornton's son, so Christine's sister.
But he should, in theory, never be released. Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. If he should ever, then he'd have to go serve in New York. But in theory, he should never.
He should never be.
So he'll only serve in the event of.
Yes. In 2013, Kathy.
In the event of the Great Fire and he gets out. Right.
All the evidence goes missing.
Yeah.
And he wants another fucking trial.
Right.
Yeah. Fuck. In 2013, Kathy Thornton's son saw an episode of 48 Hours. And Kathy Thornton was Christine's sister, remember?
Okay.
She saw an episode of 48 Hours about Alcala, and they showed pictures of an unidentified woman taken by Alcala found in the storage unit. Well, of women. They showed a bunch of pictures of a bunch of people.
Right. He had all these photographs in his evidence locker, which... And his evidence locker in his personal storage unit that turned into an evidence locker
specifically for him.
He created his own case file. Yes. Thank you, Rodney Alcala, for doing that.
Thank
that
you
made
for
the police
that.
Job so much easier.
Sort of.
Well, that all the evidence was right there, pretty neat, tied together in one place.
Yes. So he contacted his mom and he was like, this lady that I just saw on 48 Hours, like in this spread of photographs of this serial killer, looks just like you. And so his mom went and looked and like, she's like, oh, that's my sister. Like, that's your Aunt Christine.
Oh my gosh, how traumatic.
So traumatic. When Christine's remains had been found, she had been out in the elements in rural Wyoming for closer to six years. And that it was an estimated because they didn't know, because when they found her, they didn't know exactly when she'd been killed. Right.
Right.
So they knew it was the skeleton of a woman about 25 to 35 years old who had been 6 months pregnant.
So sad.
So sad.
Piece of shit.
In 2015, through familial mitochondrial DNA, Christine was identified. In September of 2016, the prosecutor and two detectives from Sweetwater County in Wyoming, so where the county where she was found, flew to California to interview Alcala. He was in poor health and was in the medical unit of the Corcoran prison outside of Fresno. They were told by prison officials he had borderline dementia. Words so hard right now. They were told that he had borderline dementia. So good luck with your interview.
Yeah.
Go ahead. They began showing him crime scene photos. And in like 2 seconds, he said, and this is the prosecutor said this, in like 2 seconds, he said, I know that area. That's my area. And how Alcala reacted to Christine's photo, detectives said was something they would never forget. They put the picture on Alcala's lap and he started tracing her image. And he did this for several minutes. And
what
according to the prosecutor and detectives, you could tell he was reliving that day in his mind. He was asked if he killed her and he said, no, you're crazy. You're stupid. And then he asked if she was alive when he left her. Because obviously they're like, dude, this picture was in your stuff. So you right. can't say you didn't fucking know her. And he said, they asked him if she was alive when he left. And he said, yes, she was alive when I left.
So he's probably lying.
Well, yeah. The fact that he admitted being there was enough for the prosecutor. And he was charged with the first degree murder of Christine Thornton. They did not, however, extradite him to Wyoming. The prosecutor said he's been in prison since 1979. Why give him a trip? He was never tried for Christine's murder. Yeah. Like, we're just, yeah.
He's like, I'm not putting his ass on a plane or in the back of a van. Fuck that.
Just sit here in this hospital.
Yeah, you can just keep sitting where you're rotting right now.
Exactly. So he was never tried for Christine's murder, but at least her family had some kind of closure and they knew what happened to her and they knew who was responsible for her death.
Right. I mean, it's justice being served enough, right, that he's just sitting there and going to rot for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
I prefer that.
I mean, the only other known survivor of Alcala's besides Tali was Monique Hoyt. On February 14th, 1979.
Sorry, I was going to put a comment before you talked about Monique really quickly.
Go ahead.
I was going to insert a comment here that I would also argue that Bridget's probably a survivor because he didn't kill her.
Yeah, but he didn't attack her either. He just...
Yeah, but still, he was creepy towards her and killed her friend and
yeah,
he didn't also turn around and go after her.
I guess that's a fair argument.
Yeah.
She's
also a survivor.
Yes.
She wasn't attacked, but she was also targeted in a way.
Yes. Because
of her friend.
Agreed.
Okay.
Okay.
Talk about Monique. Talk about our other survivor.
Okay. Monique Hoyt, on February 14th, 1979, the 15-year-old was hitchhiking and picked up by Alcala. He drove her to his apartment where he raped her. Then he took her to a secluded area in Joshua Tree, California, where he took photos of her in her underwear, as well as photos of him raping her. He bound her and gagged her and beat her and then raped her again and sodomized her. Then he bludgeoned her in the head with a rock. Monique was able to escape when Alcala went into a gas station bathroom on the drive back to Riverside. So like he was going to take her back and do who knows what more to her, you know, instead of just leaving her out there. Monique filed a police report and Alcala was arrested, but his mom posted bail. So he got out, but he got arrested pretty shortly. I mean, okay, so that was February, and assuming he was probably going to go to trial for what happened to Monique, but then he killed Robin and then he got arrested.
That took precedence over. Yeah.
So
the murder trial took precedence over the attempted.
Yeah. He killed Jill Panto also.
Yeah.
So he killed but he got caught because of Robin's murder.
Right.
So at least there's that. I mean, at least Robin got to be the catalyst, unfortunately, for his demise.
She was the victim that led to his demise, which is sad, but good in a way.
In a way. Good that it happened. Yes. But she was sad that it happened at all.
It's good that her friend, again, was vigilant and watched her surroundings and paid very close attention to what this motherfucker looked like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll post a picture of the
sketch.
The sketch, yeah, it looks just like it.
Did you look at the sketch that I made of, or that I made, that I took a picture of? I could not sketch to save my life if I had to attempt to do a police sketch. Fuck. Okay, sorry.
That's okay. The former prosecutor who was assigned to Alcala's case in 2003, so like I think his second trial, said that the dating game appearance is just a bizarre part about this case. And I think what it reflects is the narcissism and ego and arrogance of a serial killer.
Yeah, totally.
So he's like, yeah, I'm not going to get caught. An LA Times co-worker would later recall that Alcala shared his photos with workmates. Quote, I thought it was weird, but I was young and I didn't know anything. She said, when I asked why he took the photos, he said, oh, their moms asked me to. And I remember the girls were naked.
What the fuck?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because moms would want those kinds of pictures of their kids.
Mm-hmm. Lyanne Leadham, and I'm going to say Lyanne because it spelled like Diane, but with an L. So I feel like that's probably how you would pronounce it.
Leanne?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Okay. Lyanne Leadham was 17 when Alcala photographed her in 1979 and reported that he said he was a professional photographer. So in my mind, I was being a model for him. Leanne.
The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, that show I watched, Taylor, the main star of that show, her mom's name is Leanne, spelt like that, with two N's. Diane, but with an L. Yes.
Okay.
So, Leanne.
Leanne. Okay. That makes more sense.
Sorry, when you said it, that just connected in my brain of...
Good. Because, you know, I like to pronounce people's names right.
Yeah, me too.
Leanne further reported that the portfolio Alcala shared with her also included spread after spread of naked teenage boys.
The fuck?
Alcala died of natural causes in prison in 2021, which is good because the death penalty...
I was gonna ask that if he died, because I thought I'd heard about him dying.
Well, and the death penalty had been taken off the table by the governor of California. And so everybody who was on death row, their sentences were commuted to life, which is good because then you get to sit there and think about what you fucking did.
Oh, yeah, I'd much prefer them think about life. And in the... Like we talked about, too, in the instance that, you know, they were innocent and put to death.
Yep. So he died in prison in 2021 at 77 years old.
It's like death's an easy way out. You have to think about what you did staring at a wall all day long, you piece of shit.
Yes. Ultimately, he was guilty of 8 murders and convicted of 7 and believed to have as many as 130 victims.
Oh, my gosh.
Based on the photographs that were found in the storage unit. These photographs were made public. And as I said, that's how Christine was identified.
But no one else has come forward.
No one else. That's how Christine was identified as a victim of Alcala's. But I couldn't find anywhere else where any other victims had been identified by these photographs.
I wonder if anyone had come forward as like a, oh, he took my picture, but I was cool.
Yeah, I don't. It just, yeah, it said that no other victims had been identified. But that,
okay.
I mean, they said there were hundreds, if not thousands of pictures.
Yeah.
So up to 130 victims.
Right. Like, that's a lot.
A lot. That's why I said I said at least five, and you're like, well, we only know about, but there's all this fucking time and all these pictures.
Right. But you had only said three people. You didn't say
two, but Tali was attacked. But
no, you had said three. You said Cornelia, Eileen, and Ellen and Christine. So you had said three.
Okay.
All right. And not including, I'm talking people he killed.
Yes.
He didn't kill Tali. She didn't make the death count at that point.
She right? did not.
She didn't make the death count at all, ever, fortunately.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. But
so anyway, they think, you know, that there could be as many as 130 victims.
Fucker.
Yeah.
Piece of shit.
And there's a link to the Huntington Beach Police Department that has the pictures of all the victims. Okay. And they're still being circulated. So like if anybody...
Yeah, they're public so people can see them. And
yeah, they have like an Instagram page for it and stuff. So I don't know. If we can
identify a loved one.
Yeah, I didn't search for it, but we'll see if we can search for it and like link it in our Instagram.
Okay.
But that's it. That's all I got for you.
Thank you. I want to say that was great, but that was horrible. Again, that's my usual comment, isn't it? I want to say amazing work. Well, yes, amazing work. Horribly sad case, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to dive into how I really feel about it.
Okay.
Well, I already said that I felt sad for all of it, but at least he finally got caught.
Mm-hmm.
Sucks that it took the one for him to get caught. Sucks he didn't get justice served like it should have after Tali, and that, like we said, Cornelia would have died no matter what because he was in New York. But yeah, I don't know. It just sucks that he continued to go on killing sprees.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so reminiscent of Samuel Little and so many others that we've talked about. And others that are out there.
Yep. And the charming and the...
I don't know if anyone described Samuel Little as charming.
No, but, but I mean, well, that's why I said it's kind
that's
of like...
That's the Ted Bundy of
Ted
it all.
Ted Bundy-ish, you know, where he's like charming and good looking and popular and he would never...
Right. That was John Wayne Gacy, family man. He would never...
Kentucky Fried Chicken store owner.
And yep.
Yeah. All of the things.
Okay. Church member.
Yes.
Yes. All the things.
All of the things.
BTK. Family.
Yeah,
man.
No
would
kidding.
Never.
Yeah, would never.
All right. Well, that's all I've got. Is that all you've got?
That's all I've
Any
got.
Any closing thoughts?
He's a piece of shit, and I'm glad he's dead, and I'm glad he didn't get the death penalty, and I'm glad he just had to fucking rot. And I'm glad he at least got convicted of the ones that he got convicted of.
Yeah, me too.
And at least, like I said, Christine's family got closure, and they know where she is and what happened to her. Even though he didn't get convicted of it, still known that he did it.
Exactly.
Yep. That's it.
All right. Well, that's all I've got. That's all you've got. All right. Well, you can give us a follow on Instagram. That's Disturbing Podcast. Send us a Gmail if you so wish. That's disturbingpodcast@gmail.com. You can send us a case request. We like case requests. Nobody sends them, but we like them. Every time we've ever gotten one, we're like, woohoo!
Yeah.
Case request. Case request.
It's cool.
It is. It's super cool.
Super cool.
Super califragilisticexpialidocious.
Wow.
All right.
Bye-bye.